You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. You can also find us online at www.cjsf.ca, or you can call us at 778-782-CJSF.
How do we become a sustainable world? As the stakes for our survival continues to rise, so does our global consciousness. We are in the midst of a great spiritual awakening and are laying the foundations for a happy, peaceful, just, and sustainable world. With clear vision, determination, and a positive attitude, we are making sustainability happen. The transformation is already underway. You are listening to Sustainable Futures.
Welcome to Sustainable Futures. I am Ryan Fletcher. On today's episode, we have Sean Buckley of the Natural Health Products Association.
It was set up to such safety standards, you know, that you would have if you were introducing a novel synthetic chemical. You know, right down to a psychiatrist with a pager 24-hour alert, even though it's vitamin mineral stuff you can go to the health food store and get. Okay, there's nothing in there you can't go and get at your health food store. Halfway through the trial, no evidence of harm at all, Health Canada shuts the trial down.
And we have Robert Chemineur of Fog Quest. Could explain fog catching.
It's a black plastic material that covers about half the area, so you can actually see through it. And you have to, in fact, leave it open in order to collect the fog droplets, because the wind has to be able to pass through the fog collector, and it's the wind that's carrying the droplets to the surface of the mesh.
You are listening to Sustainable Futures. So it's another week. We're on Sustainable Futures. I hope you're having yourself a wonderful May Day. On today's episode, we're going to have the last segment of this extended interview with Sean Buckley from the Natural Health Products Association. He's going to continue to talk about the differences between natural health products and chemical products. He's going to tell a fantastic story about one particular natural health product that was being very effective with bipolar disorder and what happened to it. And the second interview of this episode is going to be with Robert Chemineur of Fog Quest, and he's going to explain fog catching and a not-for-profit organization called Fog Quest and what they do by fog catching, which is a method of collecting water. So here is Sean Buckley. We're just going to jump in on a question where I'm asking him about relativity, because it had been coming up a lot in the conversation. It was also a really great interview to really enlighten all of us about legal matters, myself included, of course.
Yeah, I'm finding in this conversation relativity is very important to keep in mind.
It's just rational, isn't it? I was trying to make the point earlier, how can right-thinking people say that we can withdraw, literally, probably we'll end up withdrawing about 40,000 natural health products off of the market, things that people are taking to manage health concerns, and pretend there's not a risk just because we say things are risky. Any risk analysis has to be balanced. You have to look at, okay, you're saying there's a risk. Let's identify that rationally. Let's not deny that there is a risk, but let's look at it. Let's compare it to other risks so that we can understand how much of a response we should have, because if something has a really high risk, then your response is going to be greater. And then also ask, okay, but what's the risk of the different options that we're going to propose? Really all we're saying is, you know, whenever we're going to allow the government to do something to manage, protect us, for our safety, to manage risk, we really should be demanding that it actually be a balanced approach.
Mm-hmm.
There's that old saying that you get the government that you deserve is We literally have been conditioned by society, whenever something goes wrong, to demand that the government do something. I mean, we do. Whenever there's any safety concern, any disaster, anything happens, we demand more laws. And we fail to appreciate that, well, every law takes away a little piece of our freedom.
Mm.
So we need to start also thinking more balanced. I think we've reached the point where we need to be saying to ourselves, okay, but wait a second. We also need to be protecting our freedom because that's something valuable in itself. I mean, do we want to live in a society where every aspect of our lives is micromanaged by government, where there are sanctions whenever we step out of line, and we literally have no freedom? And I always pick, you know, the motorcycle helmet and seatbelt examples because they're just such popular support, and it saves lives. Seatbelts save lives. Motorcycle helmets save lives. But, you know, when somebody stands up and asks the question, but can't I choose to take a risk? Can't I choose to ride my motorcycle without a helmet? Even if I have to pay more insurance, it's my life. Why should the state punish me, even when, you know, with imprisonment? Shouldn't I have the freedom to choose? Shouldn't I have the freedom to be a responsible adult? And I think we need to start asking those questions. It doesn't mean that we won't still choose then to have laws for seatbelts and motorcycle helmets. But we need to start asking the questions about our freedoms. Because
right.
all of us find ourselves in those situations now and again where we go, jeepers, I really feel offended that I can't do something.
Yeah.
Freedom is something to be valued.
Mm-hmm. Now, a really important question I want to get back to on the natural health products. With regulations to natural health products and just the nature of them then, how is it that health products that are chemically based, how do they come into being with, when there's such strict regulations on natural products, how do, I don't know how to say, unnatural products come to exist? How does that happen?
Synthetic, right?
Yeah, synthetic.
I mean, that was kind of the irony.
Yeah.
You know, when Bill C-51, which got consumers really upset, it was going to give these enforcement powers that I've spoken about to Health Canada to regulate drugs, which includes natural health products. And the natural health product industry and consumers were just frightened because Health Canada already is extremely aggressive towards natural health products. And you give them these, you know, move away from the rule of law, and the fear was that they would just drive them off the market in unprecedented numbers. But the irony is, and I think it was Mr. Castles from the University of Victoria that raised this during the Bill C-51 debate, is it would also create the situation where it would be easier to fast-track the approval of chemical pharmaceutical drugs.
Exactly, yeah.
So on the one hand, you have, and there's no question, we have this documented pattern that's now gone over about 20 years of Health Canada aggressively moving to restrict our access to natural health products. And at the same time, there's a parallel movement to allow faster tracking of chemical drugs, which carry an extremely high risk profile. And ironically, that's being billed, well, it's for our safety. You need these drugs faster for your health condition. So safety is being used to remove our access to natural health products, you know, ironically, stuff that we eat.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm a baker and I add more nutmeg to pumpkin pie, I don't have to do a clinical trial to show my pumpkin pie is safe. But if I add more nutmeg to a natural health product, I do, and
yeah.
Now Canadians can't get it. It's absurd.
I can see this situation now, too, that if someone wants to create a product, they would be better off putting synthetic chemicals in there if they want to get it approved.
It's just with synthetic chemicals, you have intellectual property rights.
Yeah.
Because
you patent your
chemical. There is no intellectual property rights for natural health products. So if we were in a situation where natural health products actually did carry a danger, so, you know, the state was justified in saying, no, you need, you know, double-blind clinical trials, then we would just have none because there's no intellectual property rights, so you can't get the funding to do it because then anyone can just copy you. And the industry is filled with copycats. How it works is one manufacturer will come up with, or, you know, a herbalist will come up with a product that works, and then everyone imitates them.
Right.
It keeps prices down, but as I say, innovation will now, what already has ground to a halt, so we're not going to be having the innovation happening now.
Mm. Okay. And I guess with a natural product, since it's already there, it's naturally occurring, you can't innovate it. You can't get a patent on something that's already there.
No, you can't patent, you know, garlic or cayenne or, you know, nutmeg or anything like that. And it's, you know, it's also curious when we're talking about this, you know, move to fast-track drugs, it raises a real red flag in my mind, just because I think actually our drug approval process for synthetic chemicals that haven't been in our body are not strict enough. And, you know, we've had example after example where drugs have been on the market and then, you know, there have been serious health consequences. So I'm actually thinking from a public policy perspective, we want the opposite.
And then there's also,
you know, at least I have some concerns over the integrity of our drug approval process. And, you know, I say that because of a couple of things. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with Dr. Shiv Chopra. He was a Health Canada scientist for about 30 years, and he's recently published a book called Corrupt to the Core, which listeners might want to track down, where basically he documents and, you know, he, you know, cites Senate testimony hearing under oath and news stories. It's not just him talking. You read the book and you come out of there going, wow, I can name like, you know, five or six Health Canada scientists who have publicly stated that they are pressured to approve drugs that are not safe.
Mm-hmm.
And one actually in the book, he's citing a CBC story where, you know, the scientist said, well, there's actually a pattern. You know how it's going to happen. As soon as you say, no, I've got concerns about this drug's safety, there's this pattern that falls in to try and get around the scientist's decision. And I find that terribly alarming. And I think it's something that we need to be concerned at and we need to look at, because there is such a health risk to allowing things into our, I'll say food chain, but I guess our drug chain, where there really isn't enough evidence of safety.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a different game.
Is there a push to amalgamate so that, you know, there isn't two different sets of standards, you know, on natural and synthetic products?
I think that would be a disaster, actually, because you can't treat chemical pharmaceuticals, which have, you know, a track record of being dangerous, the same as you would treat plants and herbs that we consume in our foods.
Yeah. Well, I'm talking about standards, like the standards of... Hopefully I'm not getting lost in this. It's a lot of information, but just the standards of, you have to prove the natural health product is safe, but it doesn't seem like you have to go very far to do the same thing for a chemical product.
You see, now I'm not sure that that's the case, is I think that if, you know, the law as we had written for chemical drugs, if it was, you know, applied strictly, is pretty good. I mean, that was one of Dr. Shiv Chopra's points, because he wasn't thrilled with Bill C-51, this bill to amend the Food and Drug Act. The government was saying, well, the Food and Drug Act first came out in 1930s. It's old. We need to make it modern. And everyone, you know, myself included, who works in the area, goes, well, actually, you know, the legislation is really good. Why don't you just enforce it?
Yeah.
It's a dangerous thing to be passing laws that take people's rights and freedoms away in the name of safety when you already have a set of laws that actually protects us if you would enforce it.
Right.
You are listening to a conversation with Sean Buckley on Sustainable Futures, CJSF 90.1 FM.
And that goes back to the solution then, is that it's actually just enforcing the laws that are there. Is that sort of what you can do? That's the positive thing, right?
Well, I think I would add that the solution is also common sense.
Yeah.
So if you're a bureaucracy charged with protecting our safety, then you should be protecting our safety. I mean, let me give you an example. The True Hope case. For the listeners who don't know, True Hope makes a product called EM Power Plus, which is basically a vitamin and mineral supplement. They developed it to treat bipolar disorder. They're an extremely unusual company. So you can't buy this in a health food store. You have to go through them and join a support program, because they'd learned if you have bipolar disorder, the product's just so effective, but you need to be managed. So let's say you have bipolar disorder and you are not taking any chemical pharmaceutical drugs. Really, there isn't a safety concern. You take it as directed. 8 out of 10 people get well, and you go on your way. But they found that if you're on some antipsychotic drugs, what happens is they chart you. You have to fill in these charts every day online, or they'll phone you if you don't have computer access, because their system needs to spit out graphs so the person supervising you can know what to do. They'll chart you for a while first so that they've got your baseline, and usually you've gone to them because you're really bad and the mainstream medical system isn't helping you. Then you start taking EMPOWER Plus, and I've seen the graphs. I mean, people just improve dramatically for about 2 weeks, and then you kind of get this U at the bottom, and they start getting worse again. And what they learned is happening is, well, your brain's chemistry is returning to normal, and now you're having adverse reactions to the chemical pharmaceutical drugs, and they have to do this very complicated dance of weaning you off the chemical pharmaceutical drugs and weaning you on to EMPOWER Plus. And for many of these drugs, there's extreme withdrawal symptoms, and they won't even take you unless your doctor and support people are on side, because it takes a lot of commitment. Well, back in 2001, a couple of things were happening that Health Canada attacked. First of all, the University of Calgary had done a couple of case series on EMPOWER Plus. So one they did on bipolar children, one on bipolar adults. And both of these studies showed 80% of people got better. And I think the studies ran for about 3 months, and there was about a 50% reduction in the use of chemical pharmaceutical drugs. Both of these were published in peer-reviewed journals, one in the Journal of Psychiatry, another in the Journal of Child and Adolescent Psychopharmacology. Results so blew away the University of Calgary. They've got this behavioral research unit in the Faculty of Medicine, and the lead researchers there couldn't believe the results. They'd never seen anything like it. They go to the Alberta government and they say, Alberta government, look at this data. It's incredible. We think that it's in the public interest for the government to use taxpayer funds to sponsor a double-blind clinical trial. And the Alberta government Science Foundation looks at it, they agree, and they cough up $500,000 for a double-blind clinical trial. Now, you have to realize this has nothing to do with True Hope. They're not doing this. The Faculty of Medicine at the University of Calgary is doing this.
Okay.
Okay, this had nothing to do with True Hope. This was this group of researchers at this behavioral research unit that just had not seen anything like this before.
So they're really enthusiastic about it.
They're enthusiastic. So now what we have is we have a government-funded double-blind clinical trial. It had to pass 3 ethics review boards. It had to pass Faculty of Medicine. It had to pass the, there's this, you know, Cojunk University one, and it had to pass the Science Foundation. It was set up, I've talked to the lead researcher, Dr. Bonnie Kaplan, it was set up to such safety standards, you know, that you would have if you were introducing a novel synthetic chemical. You know, right down to a psychiatrist with a pager 24-hour alert, even though it's vitamin mineral stuff you can go to the health food store and get.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, there's nothing in there you can't go and get at your health food store. Halfway through the trial, no evidence of harm at all, Health Canada shuts the trial down. Okay?
Yeah.
If you can get your head around Health Canada shutting down a clinical trial funded by the Alberta government. So they shut the trial down, and then they started attacking this company. And, you know, just so your listeners know, I mean, they were saying, oh, you didn't get our pre-approval. Now, nobody in Canadian history had ever gotten Health Canada's pre-approval to do nutrition research. And then they said, oh, well, we have a risk. I think it was, you know, we're worried about germanium. Well, they were absolutely wrong. And, in fact, 2 of the researchers at the University of Calgary are now world experts on the safety of germanium.
Yeah.
And Health Canada has now licensed that product, the same product, same ingredients, as safe. Okay?
Yeah.
Like now, just in 2008, they granted a license saying it's safe. So the whole thing was a farce. They didn't want a double-blind clinical trial getting out showing that this EMPOWER Plus is effective.
Uh-huh.
They tell in 2001, you guys stop selling it. True Hope, you stop selling. True Hope said, we can't stop selling this. People will die. Literally, they said this.
Yeah.
They said it in writing. They said it verbally. They had hundreds and hundreds of True Hope participants write to Health Canada saying, no, our lives depend on this. Doctors and psychiatrists wrote saying, no, you can't take this away. My patients depend on it. Although True Hope is an Alberta company, the product's manufactured in the United States and it's shipped across as, you know, people order. So they wouldn't stop. And so Health Canada told Customs, well, you tell us when a shipment's coming by and hold it. And then Health Canada started turning shipments away at the border. Now, the Canadian Mental Health Association, the Alberta branch, led by Ron Lajeunesse, who's a heavy hitter in the mental health field. He used to run all of the Alberta government's mental health programs.
Uh-huh.
He publicly blames Health Canada for suicides. He actually holds a press conference. So True Hope learns about this in the news, about people committing suicide when they run out of E-Empower Plus.
Right.
But the Alberta branch of the Canadian Mental Health Association was so upset, and Mr. Lajeunesse was upset about having to go to funerals. Well, still Health Canada didn't stop. They kept turning product away at the border. The Medical Post publishes a big piece about there being angst. There were so many calls to the Minister of Health's office that we know from internal emails that we had ordered disclosed by the court and through access to information requests. There were so many calls to the Minister's office that the office was getting jammed up. Well, instead of talking to Canadians and saying, well, really, what's the problem? They set up what they called the 800 crisis line. So if you phone the Minister's office or you phoned Health Canada, the minute you said True Hope or E-Empower Plus, they would just hit a button and transfer you. So you couldn't even talk to the Minister. Protests on Parliament Hill went unnoticed. It was actually, you know, a case study in how to create political pressure, and it all went no result for months and months and months while people suffered. You know, deaths were minimized because smuggling rings all across Canada popped up. And I've already told you True Hope was charged. The court acquitted them, saying that they were morally obligated to continue selling, that Canadians would have died if they had stopped.
Yeah.
And, you know, based on what actually happened, and on the evidence of Dr. Charles Popper, and let me tell you about him, because I subpoenaed him, forced him onto the stand. Once you're on the stand, you've got to answer questions truthfully, because he's actually an American. He's probably the world expert in treating people with bipolar disorder.
Yeah.
He teaches at Harvard Medical School. He doesn't teach med students or doctors. Now he only teaches psychiatrists how to become child and adolescent psychiatrists. He pioneered drug treatments on kids. So he's the guy that came up with the diagnosis of depression in kids. And, oh, here's how you adopt adult drugs to treat mental illness in children. He's the one that figured out, here's how you diagnose bipolar in children and adolescents. And here's how you adopt the chemical psychiatric drugs for adults to use in children and adolescents with bipolar.
Right.
He founded the Journal of Child and Adolescent Psychopharmacology, which is the study of using chemical psychiatric drugs on children and adolescents. He was its editor for 10 years. Now, as the editor, you get all of the research coming to you as to, you know, using drugs to treat mental illness in children and adolescents. He was also the only psychiatrist that Harvard would allow for years and years and years to have a clinical practice at their hospital. And he got the bipolar patients that other psychiatrists in that area couldn't handle. So if you had a bipolar patient you couldn't handle, off to Charles Popper they went. So he had the worst of the worst. It literally would take me 20 minutes to explain how this guy, who you could call Mr. Pharmaceutical, would allow any of his patients to try E-Empower Plus because he thought it was just snake oil.
Right.
But one of his patients tried it and did better than he could have possibly imagined.
Yeah.
So he let another patient who he just was suffering, and she got well. And then another patient, and he got well. And before you know it, he's basically got his whole practice on E-Empower Plus. And on the stand, he said it destroyed his clinical practice. And I asked him, I said, well, what do you mean it destroyed your practice? And he said, under oath, on the stand, he said, look it. When I was treating my patients with the chemical pharmaceutical drugs, I had to meet with every patient, each and every patient weekly, to counsel them not to commit suicide, and I also have to spend time managing the side effects from the drug cocktails we have them on. When I put them in E-Empower Plus, I meet with them not weekly, well, every 3 to 6 months, depending on the patient. There is no counseling about suicide because they're not suicidal. there is no management of side effects because other than, you know, stomach upset and flatulence for the first little while, it's not there. He said, I had no clinical practice. So he had to take way more patients to fill his clinical time.
Yeah.
Because he had no practice. And so I asked him on the stand, I said, Dr. Popper, what would happen if E-Empower Plus was taken off of the market? And the guy didn't hesitate. He said, there'd be deaths. He said, there'd be deaths.
Yeah.
There would be suicides. There would be assaults. You would have people engaging in the criminal justice system. And he said, I would have to give away the majority of my patients because I would have to put them back on the chemical pharmaceutical drugs and return to meeting with every patient weekly to counsel them not to commit suicide. Now, Health Canada knew about all of this, and they continued to turn shipments away at the border. They put some inspectors on the stand, and I cross-examined them about, well, you knew that Ron Lajeunesse of Canadian Mental Health Association was blaming you for suicides. Yes. Did you stop turning product away at the border? No. Well, why? Well, there's no evidentiary value into looking into suicides. And it was just absolutely crazy. These inspectors were outlining that actually adhering to the letter of the law was more important than actually paying attention to the fact that their enforcement actions were causing suffering, and if we believe the Canadian Mental Health Association, Alberta branch, deaths.
Mm.
And it's just sobering. And it shows actually the character of the bureaucracy that is now telling us that they need to protect us with our natural health product regulations and with Bill C-6.
Well, thank you very much for speaking with us here today, Sean Buckley of the Natural Health Products Association. Thank you very much for your time.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
And this has been an interview with Sean Buckley.
It's very interesting to see how this is all this all plays out between natural health products and chemical foods. So there was our epic conversation with Sean Buckley. It was quite an honor to have that interview. What a fascinating interview he was. And it must have been quite something to be able to get that much time from someone who is working on such important legal issues. I'm really quite humbled to have been given that much time. So if you're ever listening to this episode, Mr. Buckley, thank you very much. Now, this next interview is with Robert Cheminor of FogQuest. There's this thing that happens called fog catching, and it's reputed to be a very effective way to get water to people in certain regions of the world. And we're going to learn all about this and the organization FogQuest, which is a charitable organization that turns fog into water. Welcome to Sustainable Futures. I'm Ryan Fletcher, and I have Robert Cheminor on the line, and we're going to be talking about FogQuest. Robert's the executive director of FogQuest. Welcome to Sustainable Futures.
Hello, Ryan.
First of all, what is FogQuest?
FogQuest is a registered charity in Canada. It's a small charity that's been operating now for about 8 years. And what we do is very innovative water projects in developing countries. We tend to go to places where there are not conventional water supplies. So it may be a place where you cannot drill a well, where it doesn't rain for lengthy periods of time, where there are no rivers, there are no lakes. Very difficult for the people to live. And what we do is produce water using very large fog collectors. And these are simple passive devices that allow us to produce clean water in large amounts, even in deserts of the world.
Wow. So how does it work?
It's really just a method of mimicking what nature does. People who live in British Columbia, they're used to looking at hills and mountains and seeing the tops of them covered by cloud.
Mm-hmm.
And cloud is just composed of very tiny water droplets, just like raindrops, but much, much smaller. So when the cloud is covering the top of the mountain, there's fog there, because fog is just a cloud that's on the ground.
Right.
Wind moves the cloud or the fog over the terrain, and so it's moving these tiny water droplets horizontally over the terrain. And if you put a suitable tree, for example, with long needles in front of it, the water droplets will bead up as they strike the needles on the tree.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And what we do is use an artificial mesh that is very efficient at collecting these very tiny water droplets, And in fact, you need to collect about 10 million fog droplets to make a drop the size of a match head. So you have to collect a lot of these tiny droplets, but we do. And in the places where we work, there'll be billions of fog droplets a second passing through our fog collectors. So out of that, we can produce typically an average of about 200 liters of clean water a day from each of the fog collectors.
Wow, 200 liters.
That's about 400 perhaps or more of these small bottles that we all buy in the stores and carry around with us.
Yeah.
When you think that you're living in a very arid environment where your water needs per person are quite low, in fact, that's enough water to sustain a family of five people, whether it's a coastal desert of Chile or where we're working in the mountains in the western highlands of Guatemala. Those are water amounts that are very valuable, and with a number of these large fog collectors, you can, in fact, provide enough water for an entire village of a couple hundred people.
Mm-hmm. So these are mesh. What do they look like? Maybe can you give us a bit of a visual idea of what we're looking at here?
We use an agricultural shade mesh that's specially chosen for our purposes. So the easiest thing to imagine is what you see in the field around Abbotsford or someplace. You'll see surfaces that are providing shade for plants, or you'll see them sometimes put up like fences to break the wind. So it's a black plastic material that covers about half the area. So you can actually see through it, and you have to, in fact, leave it open in order to collect the fog droplets, because the wind has to be able to pass through the fog collector, and it's the wind that's carrying the droplets to the surface of the mesh.
Okay. Does there need to be fog for this to work?
There does, yes. You have to, in fact, have fog with fairly low visibilities, maybe 300 meters, say 1,000 feet or less. Once the visibility gets down below that, and if you have light wind, then the fog collectors will start producing water. And the thicker the fog and the higher the wind, the more water you produce.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why we normally are working on mountains and hills, because it's windier there, and also because the fog is more frequent. If you just sit in, say, a valley bottom where the fog is kind of thin and there's no wind, you're really not going to collect much of anything, because you need that wind to produce the water.
Mm-hmm. And then I guess if you're up on a mountain collecting water, then you have to have people bringing the water down, or a sort of a system of transport?
Actually, we use pipelines. We work on ridge lines and mountaintops and high areas. Generally, people have their homes and villages at a lower elevation, or their fields or places where they want to plant a forest. And so the water simply flows by gravity from the fog collectors down to the point of use, which can be a house or a garden. There are no pumps involved. There's no electricity. Everything is totally passive. And the wind provides the energy, and gravity moves the water.
Mm-hmm. What are some places where this is being done so far?
Well, FogQuest, because it's an all-volunteer charity and fairly small, we limit the projects we have to a couple of places at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Right now, we're quite active, as I mentioned, in Guatemala. We have 28 large fog collectors in one community there. We're working in Chile. There are about five locations in Nepal, in the Himalayas, that have fog collectors. FogQuest transferred the technology a number of years ago to a Nepalese NGO that's doing those. We've done a project in Eritrea, in Africa, near the Red Sea, and we'll probably expand that project now that the political situation allows for it there.
Mm-hmm.
We're looking at doing new projects this year in Ethiopia and also in Tanzania.
Yeah.
Some other places, Peru and Ecuador, are countries we've worked in the past. And a lot of interest in places like California, but they by and large have enough money to generate water by other means. And so they're not likely, I don't think, to employ fog collectors on a large scale in a place like that.
You are listening to a conversation with Robert Chemineur of FogQuest here on Sustainable Futures on CJSF 90.1 FM, www.cjsf.ca. You say this is a charity? A charitable?
That's right.
Yeah. Do the people that get the water have to pay anything then, or how does that part of it work?
What happens typically is that we will get donations from individuals or groups like the Rotary International Clubs that are active in Canada, and we'll get donations from churches, other places that support not-for-profit organizations that are interested in helping developing countries. And we'll use those funds usually to build the large collectors. But we'll do that with the people in the village. They have to provide the labor. And once the fog collectors are built, they have to look after them and maintain them and keep them working.
Mm-hmm.
And in any sustainable project, as you, I'm sure, are very well aware, you need to have a resource that's either very large scale or renewable.
Yeah.
You need a simple technology, but you also need a motivated and willing community. And it's the latter that's going to determine whether the project is successful or not.
Mm-hmm.
We can produce fog water in a community for the next 10,000 years. That's not a problem. Well, the problem would be whether generation after generation of the people in the community would continue to want to do the work to maintain the collectors or replace the mesh every 10 years or so in the collectors. Those are the issues. Or, in fact, like in one place, we had a community where we were producing 15,000 liters a day of fog water, a
mm-hmm.
very big project. And the community grew, and they got electricity for the first time, and they got their first gas pump, and they got a mayor that decided they were so important that they needed the government to provide them with a pipeline. They didn't want to have anything as strange as fog collectors anymore after 10 years. And so that led to local politics and led to demand they made to the local government for a pipeline,
mm-hmm.
which they never got. But, I mean, there are all these issues that affect sustainability, very practical things you have to think about.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you run into different things in every place, too.
Every country is different, you know. Some villagers are wonderful people who work very hard, and other villagers in other places are fairly lazy, and they want you to do everything for them. And in cases like that, it's not the best place to put your time and energy and resources.
So once you visit a place, I guess, does the fog catcher stay there, and then it's in their hands, or how does that work?
It does, yeah. The fog collectors are very big. I haven't really said anything about that.
Yeah.
Each one is typically about, the top of the post is about 6 meters tall, so about 20 feet. And they're about 10 meters long, so it's, you know, another 33, 4 or more feet long. So it's quite big. It's like the side of a warehouse or a fairly big building.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll put one or two of those in for a family, depending on the size. And we can put 10 or 20 or 30 or more of those in for a village. And we can either provide the water family by family, which works well in some cases like in Guatemala, or we can provide all the water to one big central cistern if that's more culturally, you know, acceptable and that's the normal way to do it there. So that's something I think people are very impressed when they see these for the first time with the size of them. And you can hear the wind blowing through them. It was a beautiful sound. And you can hear the water running in the trough because the drops of water, when they get large enough, run down the mesh and they drip off the bottom into a trough. And then the water runs down just like if you got a ladder and climbed up to the eave trough on your house when it was raining. And you looked in your eave trough and saw the water running down.
Mm-hmm.
That's exactly what you get from a fog collector in the fog.
Mm. So with these big meshes, how do you get them there?
The only thing that we typically would bring into the country is, in fact, the mesh itself, simply because we can buy it very cheaply in Chile and send it fairly long distances for not a high cost. And the cost of the mesh itself is a small part of the cost of the fog collector. Most of the cost is in the cables that we need and the turnbuckles and the hooks and the machined parts. But we buy all of that in the country itself. Essentially everything that's required is purchased in the country locally, except for the mesh.
Mm-hmm. Well, that would help too, I guess, for them if they ever needed to replace anything.
Exactly. And because the people are involved right from the beginning in the construction of the fog collector.
Typically,
men are digging the holes to put the anchors in. They're tightening the cables. They're climbing the posts on ladders. And the women are preparing the mesh and sewing the edges and doing the different components that are more suitable for them to do in the countries where we work.
Mm-hmm.
So then they have the skills afterwards, because they were there at the beginning, they have the skills afterwards to do the maintenance that's needed.
Where did the idea originate? When did this start?
It's interesting because people have probably been trying to build an efficient fog collector since around 1900, so a long time ago. But generally they didn't understand the physics of the process or the meteorology well enough. And so various strange things were built, and they weren't too successful. And it was in about 1985 that a proposal came from Chile to the International Development Research Center in Ottawa. It's an important Canadian aid agency, and asked whether Canada could provide some help to see whether fog collectors would work in the desert on the coast of Chile. I was working for Environment Canada at the time as a scientist, and King and Fog and fog deposition and air pollution related to fog.
Mm-hmm.
They asked me to go and evaluate the project, and I knew a lot of the history of what had been done in the past. And I decided that this indeed would work in the desert. The conditions were right. And so we started a project at that time with the IDRC's help to look at the technical feasibility. How do you do this? How do you understand the science well enough to build something that will take the water out of the fog and do it cheaply?
Mm-hmm.
And so we did that between about 1985 and 1992. And from then on, we've been doing projects in different countries to help communities, the ones I've mentioned before.
Uh-huh.
And in about 2001, FogQuest was formed as a charity to do this on a more organized basis, and we've been doing it ever since.
That's really wonderful.
It's something that catches people's imagination. We do a fair bit of speaking in elementary schools and high schools, and as I say, at service clubs like the Rotary clubs, and we get good support.
Where are you based out of?
We're based out of Kamloops at the moment. That's where we're operating from, simply because I moved from Toronto to Kamloops a couple of years ago.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of our volunteers and our directors are still in southern Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
Beyond that, we have a lot of volunteers in Chile and some professors that train young students that we use on our field projects.
Mm-hmm. If a listener wanted to get involved somehow or learn more, what could they do?
The simplest way to learn more about our projects is to go to our website, of course, and it's www.fogquest.org. And you'll find information there, and there's an email address there. You can contact us and, you know, ask for information, and we'll try to answer questions and send out what we can.
Okay. Is there anything else you'd like to talk about today?
I think that the one thing that I may like to mention briefly is that people often don't realize how important a water resource fog is, even in a country like Canada.
Okay.
And particularly in a mountainous area like British Columbia, fog is one of the major water inputs. In the coastal areas, probably you're looking at 25% or so of all of the water that eventually flows underground in the aquifers and that flows in the streams and rivers is probably generated by fog deposition to the high elevation forests. So there's a very important interaction between the preservation of the forests in the higher elevations and the water that's going to flow. If you cut down a high elevation forest, the same amount of rain is going to fall on that land, and probably more is going to run off, but you're going to lose the capture of the fog by the forest,
mm-hmm.
because the fog will simply flow over that terrain feature, go down the other side, and it'll evaporate.
You're saying it gets caught in pine needles, is that?
Yes, not only in pine needles, but other types of vegetation can also collect fog droplets, maybe not quite as efficiently. So a tree is a good fog collector. In Kamloops, we have lost so many of the ponderosa pine over the last couple of years. And one ponderosa pine tree on a ridgeline around here, when the wind is blowing and the fog is present, will probably collect and drip onto the ground about 300 liters of water. And you multiply that by tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of trees, it's an awful lot of water put into our ecosystems in British Columbia.
Right.
So I think that's something people don't realize, that by replanting clear cuts, you can in fact put water into the watershed, and when you take forests off the higher elevation, you're removing water, a water source from that watershed.
Mm. But I guess people are just used to thinking of, oh, the rain is the source of water.
Rain and snow is what people think about, and hydrologists by and large measure only precipitation.
Yeah.
And you ask them why they're not out there measuring the fog fluxes, and usually the question is, well, it's so hard, we have such a hard time even measuring the precipitation because we've got so few stations.
Yeah.
Do we really want to get involved in something else? But the reality is it's a big water input. In eastern Canada and southern Quebec and down through the Appalachians in the U.S., the higher elevation areas get about 40% of all their water from fog collection.
Yeah, definitely a very foggy area.
It is, up when you get in those hills. And the important thing there is, because there's a lot of air pollution, particularly in the past, the fog in those areas tends to have higher concentrations of pollutants than the precipitation.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is, even though 40% of the water is from fog and 60% from rain, the dominant pollution deposition mechanism is, in fact, the fog water deposition. Because the concentrations are higher. So that's another factor to consider when you're in an urban area like Vancouver.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very interesting. I like how natural, sort of, you were talking about how this is motivated by natural mechanisms. That's something that's happening in a lot of areas. People are just looking at the way nature works and starting to mimic it.
Yes, in some cases it can give you some very good ideas, and then you need to think through the science of what's going on, whether it's the physics or whether it's the chemistry or whatever, and see what you can do to take advantage of, you know, the ideas that nature gives you.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you very much for spending some time with us here today. We've been speaking with Robert Chiminar, the Executive Director of FogQuest. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ryan.
Hey, listener. Thank you so much for listening to these two interviews. I hope you're really enjoying Sustainable Futures. If you'd like to hear any previous episodes of Sustainable Futures, you can go to www.radioforall.net, and you can catch all of the episodes on there. I put them up there fairly regularly. Just enter Sustainable Futures into the search column, and the website again is radioforall.net. It's the number 4 on the number keypad on your keyboard. And with this FogQuest interview, I actually waited a couple of weeks, and I stormed my brain trying to find a song about fog to end this episode out with. But I could not for the life of me think of a song that is about fog, and surely there must be some out there. But anyway, I did not find one, but I do have a song to end out the show. It's a Tracy Chapman song from her album New Beginning called Heavens Here on Earth. If heaven's here on earth, then surely that must also include fog. So that's where I'm coming from here. And if you think, well, if heaven's in the clouds and heaven's here on earth, then the clouds would essentially be fog. Fog is basically low-lying clouds, so it works brilliantly. Here is Tracy Chapman with Heaven's Here on Earth. Thank you for listening to Sustainable Futures.
Distant planets, have your faith in the ever after. laughter while each of us holds inside the map to the labyrinth. And heaven's here on earth.
Could be heaven here on earth.